Radio. This is Karen Ranz, your host, and this is where the entrepreneur community and the investor community of the Southeast come together to hear from noted guest speakers and gain great information about how investors can make money through private equity transactions and learn more about angel investing and how entrepreneurs can learn how to grow their businesses so they can create wealth for themselves as well as their investors. And one of the key ways that they do that is by preparing a business that can be sold. So we have put together a great ensemble of guest speakers today that are going to talk about what is going on in the capital markets today for companies that are looking to sell their companies and what do they have to do to qualify for that to either attract a strategic investor or also to potentially attract a private equity fund to be an investor. So on our show today, we have Ed Fisher with South Point Ventures. It's a private equity fund that makes strategic acquisitions, and he's going to tell us more about the marketplace for that these days and what they look for and kind of how he got started. We also have Roy Strauss from Strauss Consulting, who is they have a consulting firm that helps companies prepare to sell. He works on the buy side as well as on the sell side. And then we're going to have Woods & Woods of Woods Business Advisory Group that operates as a broker to help companies sell and buyers buy companies. So this is, again, in one of our ongoing series for the Spec Talk Radio, where we are working hard to help investors and entrepreneurs connect. We do that primarily through the services offered through Launch Funding Network. If you can find out that information at launchfundingnetwork.com and through our angel investor group that we run, which is the Network of Business Angels and Investors at nbai.net. And again, this is Karen Ranz. So I believe the first person I'm going to bring on live here is Ed Fisher. Ed, are you there?
I'm here, Karen. Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Great. Thank you for being a part. Sorry for the little bit of the rough start there. I think I stopped that. So it's so glad to have you be on the show, Ed. You and I have known each other for a number of years. I guess when I first knew you as an angel investor and working with a firm that helped companies put some money into companies and also help them raise capital. And you've gone on to bigger and better things with your private equity fund. So tell our listeners about what you do at South Point Ventures and how you got to where you are today.
Well, thanks, Karen. Sure. Yeah, you and I have known each other a while, and I'm delighted to be here and participate in what you've built as well. South Point Ventures is a private equity fund focused on making control acquisitions in what we describe as the lower middle market, and that's generally companies with less than $50 million in annual revenues. And the type of companies that we focus on are distributors, manufacturers, and business service companies that have the primary business focus in the Southeast. They can hopefully be doing business internationally, but their operations and their headquarters are in the Southeast. And we take a reasonably long-term view of our investment and try to hold our investment for a number of years and come in and do what we can to assist the management teams or bring in management teams that can take these smaller companies and grow them into larger and more profitable entities over a number of years.
Okay, so that's great. So now one of the things that we try to help folks kind of understand in positioning the various sources of capital and also with even within the private equity space, a private equity fund is different from a venture capital fund. And one thing that you said that was particularly of note is that oftentimes what I've found is that the private equity funds focus on industries that are more to what people would call traditional versus, say, high tech that a VC might focus in. Is that what you found?
Yes, I think that's a very common distinction between venture capital and private equity. Venture capital tends to be earlier stage. They want to look for companies that are either in formation or have only been around for a short period of time, and they can see how the product or the technology or the service that company is developing has a bright future, although it may be more uncertain. They can make a bet that if it works, it'll be a really good investment. And they try to do it and find those companies at the earlier stage of their life. Private equity tends to be more focused on more stable cash flow companies that can sustain some leverage on their balance sheet and can be a little more predicted on what kind of cash flow can be produced and a little bit more expectation of what the return would be. So it's really just a different risk profile that one group is looking for versus another, and that drives them to one type of investment versus another.
So now you started this fund yourself with a few other partners, right? How'd you move into being a private equity fund?
Well, I'd been involved in a couple before South Point and have always been personally focused on principal investing, meaning being in the role of providing the capital to the companies and being in a position to determine how the capital is spent. And in kind of late 2002, the market, the M&A market and the general economy was not doing very well, but we thought that it was a good time to start looking for companies to buy. And I had one particular partner who we had looked at deals together for years and decided let's go ahead and put a stake in the ground and get South Point created. And then we attracted several other investors who agreed that the focus of the types of companies that we wanted to buy and the timing was good. And so in early 2003, we actually started South Point and set about acquiring these smaller companies, and it kind of grew from there.
Okay, so now private equity funds also take on very different flavors. Some of them buy 100% of a company and roll it up under an umbrella. Some buy a minority share of a company. How do you play in that landscape?
We generally take control, and meaning we buy a majority share of a company, and we typically do it in a fashion to where each company stands on its own independently, and those of us who work at South Point would just provide oversight and input both when requested by the companies and then from a position of board participation throughout the year. So we tend to consolidate all of our companies, not tend to. We do consolidate our companies under the South Point umbrella, but each one is an independent entity. We have the flexibility to do a minority investment, but that's not our preference. We like to retain control because our investors are counting on us to really oversee the company. And if things get a little tougher and we think a decision needs to be made that might be different than what the management team prefers, we need to have the ability to make that decision. We're clearly in partnership with management, so that's something that we hope happens very rarely. But having the majority ownership position allows us to have that flexibility. But there are private equity funds that will do minority investments. But I would say the large part of the private equity industry are control investors.
Right. So now, before we get too far into it, tell folks your website so they can go to it to learn more about your...
Sure. It's www.southpointventures.com, southpointventures.com.
Okay.
And that's the philosophy and the approach and the criteria that we use, as well as a profile on each of the companies that we've invested in.
Okay, terrific. So now there's an event coming up as well that will showcase all these different types of private equity funds that you're instrumental in the organization that is putting that on. Do you want to take a moment to talk about that?
Yeah, thanks for mentioning that. The Association for Corporate Growth is dedicated to merger and acquisition and private equity industry, and it's a 50-plus-year-old organization with over 50 worldwide chapters. Here in Atlanta, we've got a very robust chapter with over 500 members, and every February we have our annual conference called Capital Connection. And last year we had over 1,000 attendees, and the focus of the conference is to bring deal makers and deal participants together, both with entrepreneurs and capital providers. And this year it'll be held on February 10th at the Cobb Galleria. I think it starts at 8 in the morning and goes all day, So it's a really full day. And in the morning, we'll have a breakfast keynote speaker, and then we'll have our private equity marketplace where 85 private equity funds will man their tables and be available to discuss potential deals and opportunities that people have, as well as explain their investment criteria and the types of deals that they're looking for. And then in the afternoon, we'll have, I think, about 50 investment bankers who will occupy those tables and talk about the companies that they're representing and things that they're seeing in the marketplace, and be able to interact with the participants as well on what's happening in the deal market. So it's a very full day. We're very excited. It's our kind of crown jewel event for the year at the ACG chapter. So I think anybody who's in the deal market, I think, would find this very interesting and a great way to meet a lot of people all at one time in one place. So hopefully some of your listeners will be able to attend that.
And where can they go to get information and register to attend?
You can register at www.acg.org/Atlanta, and that'll take you to the ACG chapter website for the Atlanta chapter, and there should be a tab on there labeled Capital Connection. And just click on that, and that'll take you through the registration.
And so if there are companies out there that are seeking to sell to a private equity fund or to understand more, it would be a great opportunity for CEOs of companies to attend as well.
Absolutely. We really encourage and promote to the CEO and CFO levels of all companies, and I think it's a great opportunity to, at a minimum, get an update on what's happening across the financial market, as well as if you're looking for a partner or an exit strategy, it's a great place to get all in one place, a number of opinions and options and avenues for you to discuss that.
Okay, great. I've attended in the past. I'm attending again this year. So I always think it's an excellent networking experience. I learn something every time. I make fabulous connections as we work with companies in that early stage, and we're trying to chart a path so that someday they can, you know, qualify for that kind of an exit strategy, and informing our investors that is a source of an exit strategy for them. You know, when you have a private equity fund that comes in to acquire a company, and I just think it's a terrific event, and for me in the Atlanta community in the Southeast, it's a not miss event. I mean, people should plan to attend if they're doing anything in the capital markets, working with entrepreneurs, or if you're a CEO that is thinking now or in the next couple of years, you're going to want to be looking at that as part of, you know, partnering either with a private equity fund to grow bigger or to sell, then it is definitely an event to attend.
Thanks, Karen. I appreciate you promoting that as well as attending, and I agree with everything you said. I think it's a great one-stop event for people to get a great introduction, if not furthering their own agendas.
And so sort of on that topic, sometimes there's, because we will encounter entrepreneurs sometimes that are, you know, they're looking, they want to, you know, get $10 million, $20 million, or maybe a $20 million company right now, and they have potential to go to $50 or $100 million, but they're not really ready to exit it. So is it still an opportunity for them to partner with a private equity fund to sort of, you know, that has the deeper pockets, and maybe they're a traditional sector, they've got good profits, but to grow to that bigger amount like that?
Sure. Yeah, that's a common strategy. When you've got a company that's done well and you've got owners who may not be able or willing to continue to fund the growth, to bring in an outside investor in private equity can certainly function in that role. Being able to understand what the future looks like and understand the commitment that the management team has is central to determining whether you want to make that investment. But if you've got a management team that has a clear plan and is committed to that plan in the future, then that makes for a pretty attractive investment opportunity if it's an industry and a plan that makes sense. So bringing private equity in would allow the management team to potentially put a little bit of money in their pocket at that moment, understanding that they have to give up some of the future through the ownership of the equity that the private equity fund would require. But it also brings in some additional eyes and ears to help them run the business and maybe ask some questions and bring some resources that they wouldn't otherwise have internally. and also spread the risk of the future, because as much as we all want to believe in the future, it doesn't always happen the way we hope. And if you've got a partner there who can help shoulder some of that risk and burden, it can really balance what you want to do personally and managerially with your business. So that can be a real win-win for both the management and ownership as well as the investors.
Yeah. So now with all the news that we've had for the last 6 months, I guess, on sort of a lot of the bigger capital markets drying up and the challenges with some of these large investment firms and the hedge funds and things like that, have you seen a shift in the M&A market? Is it still booming like it was so strong last year, or is it kind of settled, or what's going on in the M&A market?
No, it's all the news, unfortunately, has been bad, and we are feeling the effects of that. The deal market has slowed decidedly in the last year and continues to be very slow. Deal flow has been okay, the deals that we've seen, but I'm guessing that we'll be down 25-30% in terms of the number of deals that we've seen that we'll see this year versus prior years. So you're having a situation where there's not really much leverage available to buy companies. Better companies are deciding that now isn't the time to sell. Quality has become a bigger issue. Even if you've had a nice history in your business, I think most companies right now are being very cautious and are not providing much visibility, much beyond a quarter or two at a time, if that much. And so when you take that lack of leverage and bank financing capability out of the equation, as well as a very poor visibility on future earnings, it really puts a damper on the ability to close deals. Now, deals are getting closed, but they're typically at lower multiples, purchase multiples, as well as with more seller financing requirement, either in the term of notes or rollover equity that the sellers will keep, as well as putting more onus on the sellers that require them to participate in the future, because it's just so hard to predict what 2009, much less 2010, is going to look like on a performance basis. So there are deals that are happening, but it's at a much slower pace and much lower values than have happened in the last couple of years.
So unlike maybe a strategic investor, because you hear, you know, in the press about some of these crazy acquisition prices that companies have made for, you know, sort of strategic investor being a corporation that buys a company because it fills out a piece of their strategy or it provides an innovation that they haven't developed themselves. There's a lot of a fudge factor, it seems like, that goes into strategic acquisitions that creates a much higher valuation for a company than what might be justified on their books, so which is very different from what a private equity fund looks at, I would assume. So what are some of the key things that go into when you're looking at a purchase price for a company, and given a sample scenario of a company that, you know, has the kind of revenue that you described, What's some of the things that you look for that says these guys have a proper business in order to buy it that makes sense, and how do you come up with the purchase price?
Well, I think the key thing in determining whether you want to pursue a company at all really starts with understanding what they do. What is their competitive advantage? What is the sustainability factor of what they do? And in the smaller companies that we buy, the key differentiator there is we ask, is it really a lifestyle business, or is it really a company that has a competitive distinction and a sustainability that we can count on? And a lifestyle business may be a very profitable company, but it's really just dependent and has been created by the network or the relationships or the creativity of the owner. And once that owner sells, all of a sudden you really don't have a business. All you have is a revenue stream that's connected to that owner. So we try to figure out what is the distinctive competence, what's the real sustainability advantage that this company has. And if we can get comfortable that they have a reason to exist, that there is a high likelihood that customers will continue to buy from them at fair prices, they can continue to compete with the competitive landscape, then that says to us, okay, this is one that should be a winner long-term based on those factors, and let's move into more diligence to figure out more about this particular company and its position in the industry and how it can continue to be profitable in the future. And then once we do that, we want to see that the numbers are consistent. A company that's got highly variable performance makes it much more difficult to value, and it doesn't give you as much confidence that there is stability. It may have a reason to exist, but some of the things that are unique to that business or that industry that creates that volatility doesn't give you as much confidence that you can project what the earnings would be. And really, when you're valuing the company, it really is being able to project with any confidence a level of profitability over a number of years, and then figuring out what that future stream of profitability is today. And that really just involves hopefully some good common sense and some business sense about why we think what will happen in the future has a likelihood of happening. And if we think it has a high likelihood of happening, then you put a higher value on the business. If it's less likely or there's not as much dollars involved, then it gets a lower valuation. And then beyond the predictability of the earnings and the sustainability of the position of the company in the market is the management and the management depth. We all very clearly understand that it's not just adding money that improves these companies. It's management running it well, knowing how to do it, and having some creativity and some vision about the future that really makes these companies go. And so we really have to spend a lot of time, and if we can't get comfortable that management is competent and capable, then we have to decide, well, are there some new managers that we can bring in, and that carries its own set of risks with transition, or are these guys really the ones that can take it to the next level and produce that future cash flow that we think is worth having and valuable and worth paying for. So those are kind of the initial processes and thoughts that we go through. And then once you get all those boxes checked in a favorable fashion, then it's all the kind of blood and guts of just combing through all the numbers and all the market data and all the due diligence that goes into actually buying the business.
And so you often hear that there's some sort of a multiple on EBITDA or a multiple on the revenues, and do you lean more towards the multiple on the EBITDA, which is really bottom line profit, versus the actual revenues, and does it vary by industry?
Yeah, we almost exclusively focus on EBITDA, and depending on the industry, we would also reduce EBITDA by some factor of the capital expenditures required in the business if it's a very heavy CapEx requirement business. But EBITDA is as close as you get to being a quote-unquote true cash flow number, and that's the whole point of owning a company is for the cash flow it produces. There are industries that trade off multiples of revenue, very famously in the software business. We typically don't invest in technology businesses, so we haven't had to do comparisons on revenue multiples. So all of the deals that we've done have been on multiples of EBITDA, and the easiest comparison of a multiple of EBITDA is in a private company is when you're looking at a public company and you're looking at the price-to-earnings ratio. That's basically the same surrogate that most people would be familiar with publicly traded stocks. The difference, though, in why the EBITDA multiples in private companies are significantly lower than public is that, one, there's typically less information available in a private company. They don't have to stand up to the scrutiny that public companies do, so information typically is lesser. And secondly, and probably most importantly, is the liquidity. When you own a public stock, you can sell it at any minute. And in a private company, it will take you months and months to sell your position. And both of those dictate discounts to public multiples. And back to your earlier comment about strategic buyers, particularly if they're public, they have the ability to pay a higher price, mostly because they can, in effect, arbitrage that difference into the higher multiple that the public companies put on their stock as a result of them being public. And so it's very difficult for a private equity fund, certainly now, to compete with a strategic buyer on that basis, as well as the rationalization that a strategic buyer can put on the operations of the target company. But the EBITDA multiple is the by far the standard for coming up with a valuation.
Okay, so on that topic, and I know you have to get off the phone here in just a few minutes because you have another engagement. I want to go ahead and bring Roy Strauss on so he can, you know, add to your comments about the, about, you know, sort of what you look for when you're buying a company, and then maybe you guys can share some thoughts about what kills a deal. So, Roy?
Yes, hi.
Hi. You're the one that's causing the feedback.
I'm on a regular phone. There's no computer on, and I'm talking into the handpiece with no speakers.
Okay. All right. Well, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, this is Roy Strauss with Strauss Consulting. And we're going to talk a little bit more about your actual business here in a few minutes, but I know you were listening in.
Yes.
With Ed's comment. So is there something that you'd like to add about what you see buyers looking for and how they make their buying decisions on your company?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. You know, over the years, typically the decision to buy has been coming out of marketing and finance, okay? Marketing sees that this is a product we can sell or a service that we can feature, and the financial financial people do all their analysis and look at the numbers, look at the value of the company, maybe the value of the inventory, the value of equipment, and typically deals are done based on those numbers, okay? And one of the key features that we think is really important is being able to take those numbers and benchmark them. For instance, I work with quite a few companies that are involved in helping companies buy and sell businesses. And one of the senior people told me one day, I was walking through the business that my client was going to buy with myself, the accountant, the lawyer, and my client, and we saw a production operation, and everything looked good, but we weren't quite sure what we were looking at, okay? And what was happening was what typically happens in the buy-sell deal, where they were able to get the value of the property, or in this case, the value of the lease, to see if it was the proper amount of money to pay to lease that size building. From the accounting department, they were able to get the value of the depreciated manufacturing and material handling equipment. They got the value of the inventory based on purchase price and what they could sell it for. And they got key numbers on labor, because very important, what am I paying for labor versus the competition so I can be competitive. And in each case, it was a number, but the number didn't have a real value because it wasn't benchmarked against anything. So, for instance, let's assume that the space was renting for $7 a foot and the going market was $8 a foot. But in the context of growth, if I'm benchmarking what that space should be doing for me, I have to know how long I could stay there. So if based on my growth plan, I can only stay there for 6 to 12 months, then I have to factor in the cost of moving to another facility or buying a building, which typically hasn't been looked at. When we look at the inventory, let's assume for discussion purpose that the inventory on the books is worth $10 million. Well, if numerous products are obsolete or can't be sold right now, if the company should be operating on a two-month inventory model where they hold 2 months' worth of inventory, and as in many companies' days, you'll see a year to 2 years' worth of inventory, the actual live saleable inventory may be worth only $2 to $3 million as opposed to the $10 million you're paying. If we look at the staff, again, we have to benchmark. Let's say they're paying, this company is paying labor $8 an hour, and across the street they're paying $10 an hour. Well, if across the street for $10 an hour they can produce double, then the 8 to 10 doesn't mean very much. And let me say space. And of course, the equipment. It doesn't matter what you're paying for the equipment if it's not the latest and greatest and puts you at the cutting edge as opposed to chasing the competition who can outproduce you. So, and again, I got involved in this because companies I worked for bought businesses. And we found that once we got in, we didn't have what we thought we had. So it came to my mind that if you're a seller and you're going to do a proper job, and again, a lot of just about everything Ed said was really important. I agree with him 100%. But if you're willing to spend some money to stage a $2 million house, why aren't you spending money to stage your business? That first impression, that first impression when the buyer walks in the door, if you're selling, okay, is it spotlessly clean? Does everything look organized? Do the people know what they're talking about when you ask them questions? Are they verbal? Is there good communication there? You only have one chance to make that first impression. And so the first thing we want to do when we're staging a business is make that first impression so it impresses. As soon as you turn the, as soon as you turn the buyer off by not being as good as you can be, again, problems with the deal immediately. The second
Okay, can I interrupt you just a second? Because I know Ed's going to have to leave here in just a minute. So, Ed, hearing a little bit about what Roy has offered up, do you do that sort of analysis as once you get past that first look-see at the company?
Sure. Yeah, I think Roy's comment about benchmarking is very important. I think that's a that's something that a company that's ahead of general industry benchmarks is going to bring to your attention quickly, and those who are behind don't want you to know about. So it gives you at least a reference point. Unfortunately, benchmarking is kind of an aggregate number. It's an average. So it, when you have a big enough industry that's got unique niches in it, it's certainly a guide. It may not give you a hard and fast yes or no about the investment, but it certainly gives you another data point to say, well, these guys are achieving X above the mean for this industry or above the average, and that's a good thing. Let's figure out why they can do that and how sustainable is it. Or if they're below it, but you have some expertise to understand how you can improve it, perhaps you can actually buy the business on a lower value knowing that you can improve it to get up to that benchmark. So it's certainly a valuable data point of a number of them that we would use to figure out how this company is performing relative to their industry and their peers.
Okay, well, thank you for adding that. And do you need to leave now? Want to say any final comments?
No, unfortunately, I do have to drop off. One quick last comment, because you had asked potentially about us talking about things to avoid when you are selling your company or looking at a potential investor. And I would say, while there's many things, the key thing that we found, particularly in dealing with smaller companies and entrepreneurs, is treating this kind of decision as a business decision. We have a long list of deals that we didn't do because the owners really hadn't committed to the deal. And they treated it very emotionally, and we understand that when an entrepreneur builds his business over 25, 30 years, it's a big part of who they are, and we understand that, we respect that, and that's a lot of what built this country, so it's a terrific thing. But when you get ready to sell it, make sure that you've taken the time to go through personally and done the things to prepare yourself for someone else owning your baby or someone else coming in to direct activities and doing the best you can to remove the emotion from the process. And we've had several deals were literally at the closing table. They said, I can't do this, and they walked away. And that's certainly their right and their prerogative right up until that point. But being committed to doing this takes some time, and I think firms like Roy's can get there early and start working with them on what's about to happen. So when they get ready to do it, they're truly ready, they're truly committed, and we can all sit down and hammer through the details and get to a successful conclusion.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Ed. And this, again, is Ed Fisher with South Point Ventures.
That's, thank you, Karen, for being on your show. Sorry I have to drop off, but I'll look forward to hear another broadcast soon.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Karen. Bye-bye.
See you in February. Okay, so, Roy, you're still on the line?
Yes.
Hey, would you do me a favor and call back in and see if maybe that we'll drop the reverb, because I heard it coming in on Ed as well. So
I'll do that right now. Okay.
Okay. So we have another caller here. I'm wondering if this is our is this Woodson? Are you on the line?
Hi. Yes, this is Woodson. Hi.
Hi, Woodson. We're gonna have Roy call back in here in just a minute. So I appreciate you being on the line.
No problem.
And listen, have you been able to listen to most of the show so far?
Most of it.
Okay, great. Well,
hi, Cameron.
I'm going to, hey, Roy, you back on the line?
Yeah, is that any better?
It sure is.
Yes, it is.
I'm sorry I didn't call back sooner.
Yeah, so, I mean, sometimes that happens to me when I call, you know, the phone lines just do those funky things. So, so now that I've actually turned the mic on for Woodson as well, so, Roy, take a moment. You gave some great insights on some of the things that you see acquirers look for. Tell us a little bit about your background and how you got gained this expertise in helping companies prepare their business to sell, and then we'll have start to have the exchange with Woodson, who represents the buyers and sellers. I know both of you guys are deep into that process of helping companies prepare their business to sell and actually attracting the buyers for them.
Sure. Okay, so this month is the beginning of the 27th year of the Strauss Consulting Group. Before I started the company, I had the good fortune to work for 10 years for a company that was in hypergrowth. We grew tenfold in 10 years, and during that process, we bought out three other companies. And since I'm on the operations side as director of operations, I would inherit all the problems as the result of proper due diligence not being done by the folks who own the company doing the deal. And that's what led me to knowing we had to benchmark. Okay, in one case, we bought a business and it had to move within 6 months. And again, had the growth plan been turned into, had the marketing growth plan been turned into an operational growth plan, which is what we preach, then we would have seen that the correct amount of space wasn't there, and that should have been taken into consideration as part of the buying process. Okay, so again, having spent 10 years working for a company that grew like this, and again, every company, whether you're buying, whether you're selling, you must understand the growth component completely. Company after company puts out a marketing growth plan saying this is how we're going to grow, but there's never an operational growth plan to make sure it's going to happen. Okay, so now when I'm working with companies that are selling a business and, you know, marketing puts out, well, we're going to grow 10% a year or whatever the number is, I make sure that when the buyer says, well, how is this going to happen, we're prepared to answer that properly. So when a good buyer does due diligence, we could give them the real answers they need so they can judge what the real deal is. Okay? So again, as I mentioned, we've been running the consulting company now for 26 years, and it started out specializing in supply chain logistics, which we work with companies with products of any kind, whether they sell them, distribute them, or manufacture them. And again, supply chain, the whole business from sourcing raw materials through delivery on their final customer's doorstep. And so we help with growth planning, product mix, inventory management, space planning, process and systems to make sure everything is going to work, staffing, equipment, automation, and technology. Okay. So we think that if it's a company with a product of any kind, well, all these skill sets are really important for both the buyer to know what they're getting, and even more important for the seller, so a sophisticated buyer will want to buy your business. Okay, so moving forward now. Okay, as I mentioned, when we're working with buyers, we help them through the benchmarking process, and when we're working with sellers, we want to make sure that business is going to show as well as it possibly can. As I mentioned the term before, staging the business. And again, because we came in a little bit from the end of it, because we were saying goodbye to Ed, just to repeat quickly, that first impression is so important. Okay, the business has to look organized. It has to look clean. When someone sees numbers for the first time, the numbers have to be right. You can't put public numbers out in a business plan or in an advertisement to sell the business. And if someone comes in and looks at the books, the numbers don't match. Red flag right away, trouble selling your business. Really important senior level professionals to make sure you're doing it right. You must have the proper attorney, the proper investment banker, and as required, the proper consulting staff to make sure that what you're selling gets presented as well as possible and to reduce the potential problems and potential issues as the good buyer is doing proper due diligence. So as you mentioned, Karen, we work with both buyers and sellers. And Ed made a great point, okay, when you're doing your benchmarking, if you find that you're buying the business, you find that many of the performance levels are not what you'd like them be through the through the benchmarking process, then what we would do is on the buying side, help the buyer get the price down because these things are not up to snuff, and then after they buy it, go in and help get everything working right so they can achieve the growth they want to achieve. Our goal for every client is to optimize customer service at the lowest possible costs. Okay, and one more thing, at Strauss Consulting Group, as I said, with supply chain, we work with companies that have products. We also have a sister company we work with that works with service companies and any other type of company to make sure that their deal is happening just as we would make sure our clients' deals are happening properly.
Okay, so that sounds great. Tell folks your website and how they can get more information.
Sure. My website is www.scg4u. So www.scg4u.com.
Okay. So terrific. So I'm going to bring on Woodson Woods now, who is in a similar space, because this is the whole topic is how do you prepare a company to sell and how an entrepreneur attracts. And then also, I think we'll have both of you talk about what buyers are looking for and what buyers need to make sure that the gotchas that they have on potentially on their end. So Woodson, introduce yourself and tell us about your business.
Sure. Woodson with WoodsBusinessGroup.com. I do both buy side and sell side. Really companies in the $1 to $50 million revenue range. It does vary. In the past, I've worked with foreign companies to buy U.S. companies, foreign public companies to buy U.S. companies, down to sell side of companies doing the high six figures range. So the $1 to $50 million is sort of a general range that we typically like to work in. That's kind of where the focus, and the industry varies quite a bit based on client.
Okay. So now how did you get started in this business, and how long have you been doing it?
This is a culmination of a growth since through college on. Basically studied economics at UNC, worked for a brokerage firm when I first got out of school, and then got into senior level business development executive to senior sales, which analyzed business process and a business, and in that process of analyzing a company and reformulating that information to close deals for CFOs and so forth, gave me the analytical skills that I needed, and also, of course, the personal relationships and business skills and managing the sales process until close. So therefore, business brokering / lower middle market M&A is essentially a natural progression in career growth.
Okay, so great. So, you know, you've been, so what do you see happening in the market? Earlier, Ed talked about how there's, because of the long-term debt that you normally fund part of an acquisition with has kind of dried up of late, that it's been more difficult, or he's not seen as many deals getting done. What has been your experience in this M&A space right now?
Well, overall, according to M&A Magazine, I believe overall deals are down in some sectors, some 55%. So it really depends. However, though, there's some industries that are doing relatively okay, life sciences, healthcare, energy. As of late, I've been approached by a number of different financial buyers as well as private equity firms interested in manufacturing and distribution. But overall, you're looking at relatively companies with relatively inelastic demand seem to be doing somewhat fairly well, such as grocery stores, chains, waste management. In other words, in last demand meaning, you know, no matter how bad the economy gets, you're still going to buy groceries. Those types of sustainable have been affected less than others. But overall, yes, it has been down quite a bit.
Okay, so in hearing what the other folks have said, what do you think is the best would you have anything you want to add to what Roy has said or Ed has said about what a company needs to do to prepare themselves? You know, Ed's highlights were, you know, they need to really be able to show they have a competitive advantage. And it was interesting because it's management that actually builds a company, the management can't be so entrenched in it that it's all about the management, because the company has to be able to scale beyond them. But then management, it still comes back to, you know, management has the ability to execute as the company grows. So when these private equity funds are coming to you, are they looking for all-out acquisition, so management exits, or are they where management is still in play? And what does a company need to do to prepare depending on that scenario?
Most of the private equity firms I've spoken with, they actually want to take over management, either put in their own management and do some sort of earn out with the current buyer. Most of my experience on the buy side is more a strategic buyer with international space. But private equity firms have seen that they've been more active as of late, I guess, in increasing the deal flow of reaching out to intermediaries such as myself to increase their pipeline. I believe I've mentioned that it's a little bit smaller than normal. A decrease a little bit more. I guess from the sell side perspective, in terms of preparing a company for sale, I'm not really focused on really analyzing the company and truly understanding what is potentially missing. For example, I think one of the issues that you spoke of before, what are some things that they can do to that they need to avoid? In other words, you know, not misrepresenting or omitting information. And once you find that inefficiency, basically put a dollar value to that and address that issue up front. Those are some of the things that will actually kill deals as well.
Okay, so is that, Roy, has that been the same thing that you've seen as far as that one of the biggest ways that a deal will get killed? Ed said, you know, management not having realistic perspectives, but also having just misrepresentation of information? Is there anything else?
First of all, I just want to add one thing about the current climate, okay? Because of lack of available finances, a lot of the equity deals are not happening right now. The two areas that we are seeing some acquisitions being done, first of all, a lot of the pharmaceutical companies are greatly reducing their R&D budgets right now because of the economy. And so instead, they'll look to buy another technical company or a smaller product company where they could add to their product line. And we also see the economy hurting companies where you have two companies in the same industry or same business, and they're both struggling. And by merging, they can reduce overhead and gain economy of scale. So those are two areas where there is some potential for business to happen right now. Okay. Maximizing their value when seeking a buyer. Again, the first thing we talked about earlier was making sure that everything that's visible is spotless, it's clean, it looks great, okay? The second thing is, and you mentioned it, Karen, on the numbers side, okay? Some of the companies, especially the smaller ones, may not have a CFO, or their books are being done by an accounting firm. And it's really important that you have a CFO on your side working for you so you can provide the metrics the way you want them to present it and make sure everything is proper and done professionally with the books. What you don't want to happen is that the buyer says, okay, well let my CFO look at it, and, of course, they're going to be looking at it the way they want to present it, not the way you want it presented. And, again, also by not having that CFO, you're looking a little bit less professional. So if you're thinking about selling the business, bring a CFO in to make sure that you're doing the whole financial part of it properly. And again, just like you're staging the business, you're presenting the numbers the way you want the numbers presented.
Okay. And also to add to that, in terms of preparing a company for sale, looking at management and overall operations, are there ways to cut costs without affecting overall operations? Have you identified key management individuals that would stay with the company, and also maintaining that confidentiality throughout the sales process so your key players, our best employees, won't leave, get antsy when they hear M&A activity. They usually think of instability. And And of course, looking at various liabilities opportunities that may come up, whether it's FDA, OSHA, EPA, any potential lawsuits that may uncover or kill a deal as well. Other things you may want to look at.
Okay, so now when you're, you know, one of the comments that Roy made earlier was, you know, making the company seem, you know, there's under the covers work that has to be done that make sure that their processes are documented, their financials are accurate and current, that they've, you know, that they've, you know, created the systems that helps them to, you know, be able to actually, you know, show the value that the business can, as Ed put it, be, you know, sustainable, and that their revenues are consistent. And but a business cannot get top dollar if they haven't prettied themselves up, so to speak, as Roy described. So they just don't look like they're together. So even though down underneath the covers they may be together, they may not look like they're together. Have you found that as well, Woodson?
Yes, I've found that as well. I mean, other things you want to look at just to increase the attractiveness, you really want to maximize as much as you can. Look at everything from vendor contracts, insurance costs, utilities, business or outsourcing other companies as well to increase the overall value of the business. And then one of the things also in terms of managing, especially more so in smaller companies, that I've found is if you have that buyer that's close to retirement or potentially burn out, it's very important to have them to continue to focus and drive the company in terms of sales and marketing. I've had clients in the past that they put it on the market and they kind of set back and thought it was over. And you want to show that upward growth trend to continue even after you put it on the market. And just that's one of the things earlier. And that happens more so in the lower end where their owner has more of a direct effect on the growth and the drive of the company as well.
If I may add one thing, Karen.
Sure.
When you're looking to buy a company, you want to make sure that the owner of the company that you're buying it from isn't the company. Okay. When you ask the question, what would happen to this company if the owner went on a cruise for a month and would there still be a company there? Okay. It's really important if you're buying a company to make sure that there really is a company there, and if the owner leaves, the company doesn't leave with it.
Right. Right. So there's these, I guess I've heard of this term, golden handcuffs. Do you guys see that as a sort of an insurance policy that they put in place with the company that keeps the founder or the CEO or the key management in place through a transition effectively?
What I found actually with some of my clients, especially foreign buyers, who would do more of a 2 to 3 year earnout with the owner, where they have a vested interest during the transition period to continue to grow and drive the company as they acclimate the customers, suppliers, and vendors with the new management. So there's no drop-off with the change, and also gives the new buyer an opportunity to really learn, master, and understand the company and any operational economies of scale that can be achieved through the acquisition as well.
Yeah, and if I may add to that, Karen, what we were talking about there is companies that are people-dependent rather than system-dependent, which we see too many of those. So what we would do is go in and define how the company is being run and develop systems that people could be trained to use to run the company, manage a company, act within the company's requirements, and take the human equation out of it. When we work with a company, one of the first things we want to do is systemize it, because we don't want to be working with a company where something happens to the owner or that key person, and then we have a major problem just keeping the company running. So wherever we go, we want to systemize and get away from people dependence.
Right, absolutely. So that's something that, Roy, you do. You help them, you go in and help them systematize, and particularly in the anything in within the supply chain space. Is that part of what you offer?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. When we meet with the company for the first time, we're going to ask them questions about the growth plan, where it came from. Do you have contingencies? If you grow faster than you thought, can you take good care of your customers? If you grow slower, will you still be in business? And we help clients by putting together operational growth plans that are going to make sure that the marketing growth plan is going to work. And part of that operational growth plan is systemizing the business. so it's not dependent on those people that are running it to make it happen. And the people that are running it can delegate, and therefore whoever's operating within the system will be able to run it at optimal efficiency and the way management wants it to be run.
Okay, so now, Woodson, you as a broker, you expect that work to have already been done. Is that right?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, I can analyze, and what I usually do is if there have that deficiencies there, I typically introduce them to a business consultant to work with them on however long it takes, whether it's a couple of months or 6 months or a year, to get everything in order. And then once it's packaged from that point, then it's when I review it, take it to market, properly package, and find that buyer. Negotiate the process to sell as well. So I would actually bring in a consultant to work with them on a daily basis to get them up to speed if it's one of those, if it's a long-term, not a short fix, if you would.
Right. Okay, as we get ready to wrap this show up, I thank you both for coming on to the show and sharing your valuable insights. Roy, go ahead and tell everybody again how they can reach out to you to get more information.
Oh, sure. Okay. Again, our website is www.scg, as in Strauss Consulting Group, scg4u.com. That's number four and letter U. www.scg4u.com.
Okay. And Woodson, as the person that connects those companies, some companies selling their company, connects them with the capital or the potential buyer, and somebody who obviously sounds like you've got a bench of buyers that are looking for companies to sell. Tell folks how they can reach out to you and learn more about how to engage you.
Absolutely. You can give me a call at 678-612-4798. Also go through the website at Woods, that's Woods, businessgroup.com. And it'll give more insight into the process and so forth.
Okay,
yeah.
So terrific.
Karen,
and, yes?
Karen, if I may, also my phone number, 201-337-7108.
Okay, so thank you so much, both of you, for calling in and being a part of the show. I think you've offered tremendous insights for any of the companies out there that are either ready to sell their business now or thinking about selling it. Just to sort of recap, you know, whether it's a private equity fund that's doing the buying or a strategic acquirer or corporation that's looking to fill out, they're going to want to know that that company has a competitive advantage in the marketplace, that it's sustainable and scalable, that they've got a consistent set of revenues, that the revenues and the documents, the financials are accurate, that they are well documented and processed with their agreements, their joint ventures, their contracts, everything's up to date, that they've got all of those pieces of information together. The management has the depth to execute on the next generation of plans that they have, and that they and that they really need to, once they've kind of got their closet cleaned up, so to speak, you know, their under the covers is cleaned up, they really need to dress themselves up as well, just so, if anything, to maximize the potential value of the company or the perceived value of the company, but also even just to get past the first date with an acquirer. And I think both you guys bring a great expertise into the market of how to help a company do that. And If a seller comes to you, Woodson, that hasn't quite had it, then you engage the appropriate, tell them that and get the appropriate resources for them. So you guys have just done a terrific service for us in educating our entrepreneur community, and thank you so very much for joining us. Any final comments before we sign off here, Woodson?
Thank you, Karen, for having me. I do appreciate the opportunity as well.
Okay. And Roy?
Yes, again, likewise. Thank you so much. Appreciate the opportunity, and I'm really hoping we were able to be of help to your listeners.
Yeah, I'm sure you were. And thanks again for everybody for tuning in. This is Southeast Private Equity Southeast Private Equity Community, the Spec Talk Radio Show. We'll be back here next week with a very interesting topic regarding raising venture capital funds. So please tune in, and more information about the services that LaunchFN offers, you can go to launchfundingnetwork.com. and learn about our upcoming event on February 11th. And looking forward to working with both of you guys as we work with these companies and identify the types of capital they need and the exit strategy for our investors. Thanks again, and y'all have a great weekend.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.